You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. Every listener matters, and we're here because of listeners like you. Thank you for all your support.
From Hamilton, Ontario, this is the Green Planet Monitor, your weekly report on Earth systems, human development, justice, and science. Today, Earth's oceans, 700 million years ago, frozen solid, apparently. A Canadian geologist speaks about Snowball Earth. And today, Earth's oceans are liquid, and they're taking a wallop. Ocean scientists assess the damage. This is the Green Planet Monitor. I'm Dave Kattenberg. Before diving in, a quick appeal. If you appreciate what you're hearing, subscribe to the Green Planet Monitor, greenplanetmonitor.net. Now, the news with Kylie Wong.
Violence against education is growing around the world, with attacks on schools, students, and teachers rising by 40% globally in the last 2 years. According to new research, there have been more than 8,500 recorded incidents of students and staff being killed, injured, abducted, or arrested in 2024-2025 in 83 countries. Most attacks occurred in Colombia, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Ethiopia, Haiti, Palestine, and Ukraine. The incidence of military forces or armed groups occupying schools has nearly doubled from the previous 2 years, with almost 2,000 recorded cases. In my view, this is more systematic rather than episodic, and attacks are increasingly strategic, said Dehendra Farali, professor of education at University College London. Just days after the U.S. announced a breakthrough in negotiations with Iran, renewed fighting between Israel and Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah highlighted how precarious the situation is. Since its military assault began in March, Israeli forces have killed more than 4,000 Lebanese, including almost 800 women, children, and healthcare workers, injured over 10,000, displaced over a million, and destroyed dozens of villages. About a fifth of Lebanon is now occupied by Israeli forces. About 50 Israeli troops have been killed. The first clause in the 14-point peace plan between the U.S. and Iran calls for a ceasefire in Lebanon. Iran wants Israel to withdraw completely. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, wanted by the International Criminal Court for a host of war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Gaza, has insisted Israeli troops will stay in Lebanon, free to commit violence as long as it wishes. While billions struggle to meet basic needs, the consumption habits of the wealthiest 10% wreak damage on the planet, pegged at almost $6 trillion a year, experts say. The greatest damage is linked to consumption of red meat and energy and luxury flights around the world. Researchers at the University of Oxford and University of Leiden in the Netherlands estimated the monetary impacts of climate disruption, biodiversity loss, nutrient pollution, and freshwater use. If anything, these numbers are conservative. The bill leaves out the emissions tied to wealthy people's investments, said Paul Behrens, a British Academy professor and co-author of the study. The use of artificial intelligence in Canadian prisons is raising concern among prison rights advocates. A pilot project by Correctional Service Canada aims to improve efficiency by processing large volumes of prison data. AI will support rather than replace human decision-making, prison officials say. But civil liberties advocates, legal experts, and opposition politicians have raised concerns about transparency, bias, accountability, and the risk that flawed AI-generated assessments could affect inmate treatment, rehabilitation opportunities, or release decisions. And that's the news. Back to you, David.
Thanks, Kylie. Long before life exploded on Earth and Earth's oceans, between about 630 and 720 million years ago, Earth's oceans were covered in ice, many meters thick. Beneath that ice, darkness reigned and hardly any life existed. Snowball Earth is how geologists describe Earth's status back then. Last week, the scientist associated with pioneering the Snowball Earth idea, Paul Hoffman, gave a talk at McMaster University. Hoffman is a Canadian geologist and a McMaster University grad. He taught for years at the School of Earth and Ocean Sciences in Victoria and is now Sturgis Hooper Professor Emeritus of Geology at Harvard University. Hoffman specializes in the Precambrian era of Earth time, before the first animals emerged. I interviewed Paul Hoffman back in the early 1990s for my Earth Chronicles series. When I heard he'd be giving a talk at MAC, I registered. Hoffman's presentation to a room full of MAC grads was magisterial, both engaging and intellectually challenging. Hoffman reviewed the evidence for Snowball Earth involving geochemistry, paleoclimatology, biology, and molecular phylogeny. After his lecture, Paul Hoffman accompanied me to the studios of CFMU-FM, where we sat down for a talk about Snowball Earth. Paul Hoffman, welcome to the Green Planet Monitor.
Pleasure to be here.
Ideas like this in science, there's always an aha moment, a moment of sudden revelation and inspiration where you scratch your head and go, I don't understand this data, what does this mean? And suddenly you think, okay, this is what it means. So when was it that it came to you that Earth actually went through a period when it was totally glaciated?
When all
the oceans were frozen?
Right.
Because this was a totally heretical idea at the time.
Right. Yeah. So I had already been at Harvard for 2 years. And I'd been working in Namibia for 5 years, and I hadn't published a single paper. But I had a lot of data. And one of the pieces of data I had were carbon isotopes from carbonates deposited from ancient oceans that were a record of the carbon isotope composition of the ocean.
And for people who don't know, we've got carbon-12 is the most common
isotope. It's the ratio of carbon-13 to carbon-12, and it's essentially governed by the relative proportions of a burial of abiotic carbonate versus organic matter. And the isotope suggested that for a long period of time, there was no organic matter being buried at all. And so the aha moment, the eureka moment, came when a marine geochemist named Peggy Delaney visited Harvard to give a talk. And I was one of the faculty, and I got to talk to Peggy Delaney for 20 minutes before the talk. And I described this carbon isotope data I had to her. And at some point, she got very frustrated. And she said, the problem with you is you don't understand the time scale of the carbon cycle, which is undoubtedly true because I was a newcomer in this. And she said, you need to read this paper by a certain guy who's at Penn State, Lee Kump. And he wrote a paper on the aftermath of the Cretaceous tertiary mass extinction when this big meteor, you know, hit the Earth and the Yucatan Peninsula and everything. And this was right before her lecture, so I took note of that. I went to hear her lecture, and then we went out to dinner afterwards, and the dinner broke up about 10 o'clock in the evening. And instead of going home, of course, I went back to the office and looked up this paper. And the paper said, at the end of the Cretaceous tertiary mass extinction, because life in the surface ocean was extinguished for a brief period.
Which is like 65 million years ago.
This was 65 million years ago. And in the aftermath, for a few months, because of all the dust and whatnot that could put up in the air, there was no photosynthesis. So organic productivity collapsed in the ocean for a brief period of time. So there was, you can see the effect in the isotopes. There's a drop, but not a big drop, and it doesn't last very long. But he went on, this paper, by saying if the oceans had been abiotic basically for hundreds of thousands of years, then the carbon isotope composition would go to a mantle-like value, which is what I had. And so I said, wow.
It would totally drop.
It would drop to -5, -6 per mil, as opposed to normal, which is around 0 per mil. At the end of Cretaceous tertiary, it dropped to -2 per mil. But it didn't drop to -5, -6. But my data did drop to -5, -6. So the paper, this Lee Kump paper, said, if you cut off photosynthesis for hundreds of thousands of years, what you would get is -5, -6. And so I said to myself, well, how would you cut off photosynthesis for hundreds of thousands of years? And the answer was obvious. You cover it with ice.
Because, of course, most photosynthesis even today is happening. It needs sunlight, but it's happening in the ocean.
It's happening. Well, now we have land plants. But in the Precambrian, you didn't have land plants.
Right.
And so the photosynthesis at that time was almost entirely in the ocean.
And for those who don't know, but the Precambrian was when?
That was before 540 million years ago.
Okay.
Which is the time when animals first started making little shells that can be preserved as fossils. That's what's called the base of the Cambrian. Animals evolved not too much long before that time, less than 100 million years before then, but they weren't making fossils.
And so you surmise that back then, at the end of the Precambrian, Earth's oceans were totally frozen.
Then I said, well, the only way you can have no productivity in the ocean for hundreds of thousands of years would be to cover the ocean with ice, with thick ice, so the ocean would be dark. And if it's dark, then there's no photosynthesis, there's no primary productivity, which is the base of the marine food web, and everything would collapse.
And you called this Snowball Earth.
No, the Snowball Earth term had already been invented by a friend of mine who told me about this phenomenon. So I wasn't, I didn't invent the concept. The theory was already there. The word, the application to geology was there. The name was there. But it hadn't been prominently published, and nobody believed it. And nobody was really doing the work to say, I call myself Kirschfink's bulldog. Joe Kirschfink was the guy who came up with the term Snowball Earth, and he was the first one to apply this concept of the frozen ocean, which climate physicists had come up with decades earlier. He applied it to the geologic record.
Okay, so now...
But he didn't do anything with it.
So now we refer to these as the Marinoan and the Sturtian periods. The Marinoan was like about 640 to 635 million years ago,
yep.
And the Sturtian
was 717 to 662.
So why didn't anybody believe... Why the skepticism?
Well, first of all, people saw that there were marine fossils of photosynthetic organisms before and after and between the two events. And they said, well, these things survived. So how could the oceans have been frozen? Because they assumed that the survival would have been in the oceans, which I think is not correct, but they assumed that. And also, the geologists, they didn't read any of that climate physically, so they didn't understand, how this could occur. It just seemed to be a crazy idea to them. The climate people had already, to them, the puzzle was why this hadn't happened, because they assumed it hadn't happened, but the theory predicted that it should have. It seemed to be happened easily enough that it was almost miraculous that the Earth had escaped. And initially, the climate scientists assumed that if it did occur, it would be permanent, and therefore it couldn't have occurred. And then sometime later, it was appreciated that it could occur, but it would be self-reversing because volcanism would continue, plate tectonics would continue, and carbon dioxide would continue to be emitted by volcanoes, but you couldn't get rid of it.
Which would warm the atmosphere.
Would slowly warm the atmosphere as it builds up. And the CO2 is normally removed from the atmosphere by rainwater and then reacts with rocks to produce calcium carbonate, which is buried as limestone. But if the Earth is frozen, then there's no rainwater. There's only snow. And carbon dioxide is not soluble in snow or ice, only in liquid water. So you can't get rid of it. So it accumulates and gets higher and higher. But you need an awful lot of it. And that's why the prediction is that if you ever had a snowball, it could self-reverse, which means it can't be ruled out a priori from the geologic record, but it would be very long-lived. That's one of the predictions. It's very long-lived. And then the other predictions are that the onset and the termination should be globally synchronous. And those predictions now have turned out to be true.
What would have induced these snowball periods?
Uh-huh.
What made
them
happen?
Well, that's still a matter of argument. Huh. It's uncertain. There are a lot of things that could have done it. One of which is the evolution of algae that produce dimethyl sulfide in the air, which acts as cloud nucleation a site. And today, there's no difference in the whiteness or the albedo, the reflectivity of the oceans relative to the land. You would think the land would be a lot brighter, would be more reflective than the oceans. The oceans are dark, or very dark. They absorb most. But the oceans are much cloudier than the land. And that cloudiness has a lot to do with phytoplankton that live in the ocean that produce dimethyl sulfide precursor, which is this cloud nucleating thing. So when that facility by organisms first evolved, then that would have increased the reflectivity of the Earth. And so for a period, it would get colder. Now, the carbon dioxide would automatically adjust to compensate for that, but that adjustment timescale would be quite long-lived, might be a million years or so. So there'd be an interval when there'd be a strong cooling effect. But there are a number of different things. There is a huge volcanic eruption in Arctic Canada that extends all the way from Yukon to Greenland. It's called the Franklin Large Igneous Province. It was a great, flood basalt field, like the Deccan Traps in India, which broadly coincide with the Cretaceous-Tertiary mass extinction. That flood basalt field was sitting right on the equator when it was erupted. Okay, so there are two ways that could have caused a snowball Earth, one of which would be by ejecting sulfate aerosol into the stratosphere, which also causes incoming sunlight to be reflected and lost. And the other thing is the lava is very unstable because it's a high temperature, assemblage of minerals, and it was very susceptible to weathering. And so you get intense weathering in the aftermath. So those are two ways in which this enormous flood basalt province, because it's very large, and it was right on the equator, which is the warmest and wettest part of the Earth in a normal climate, could have been a trigger. And there are a number of other triggers. There was a supercontinent that broke up at that time. That would also increase weathering, because large areas of the continents were previously far removed from the oceans and were dry.
Was that Rodinia?
That's Rodinia. And when Rodinia breaks up, then a lot of land areas become much closer to the ocean, so it become wetter. So more weathering. Weathering consumes carbon dioxide and would have a cooling effect. Also, there's more erosion, more sediment burial. That allows more organic matter to be buried. That also lowers carbon dioxide. So there are a number of, very plausible and probable factors, but their relative importance for these particular events, and the two snowballers didn't necessarily have the same trigger because the volcanic plateau, was coincident with the first snowball onset, but not the second. So that's still a matter of debate.
I remember you telling me many years ago, the last time we spoke was 1992, that the breakup of Rodinia may have triggered or precipitated the Cambrian explosion of life, which occurred about, 525 million years ago. Rodinia broke up when? 700 million years ago?
Around 8. It began to break up around 820.
With all this volcanism.
And it continued to break up until around 700 or less.
And all this volcanism generated highly reduced compounds that were a source of energy, which drove the Cambrian explosion. Mm-mm. It's interesting that at the same time you're saying that the breakup of Rodinia may have precipitated Snowball Earth.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the question is, like people say, where did all life in the oceans and the surface of the Earth go to when Earth froze over? This would have been a calamity.
Yep.
In fact, your argument is that, and that of others, is that it triggered a radiation.
Yeah. Well, the origin and initial radiation of multicellular animals from the molecular record does coincide with the Snowball Earth events, but we don't know why. It's not at all clear what the causal connection, if there is one, what that would be.
But your argument, the point you made in today's talk, was that it was around the equator where the surface of the oceans or land surface was not frozen, so it was a refugia.
Well, it was frozen. Those things are on ice, but there was meltwater on top on the ice surface because of the dust. So those refugia were on a frozen ocean, but there were meltwater ponds and on the ice because there was net ablation there. In other words, instead of having snow accumulating, there was water vapor was being formed. So you had bare ice, and so dust tended to collect on the surface, which is darker, absorb sunlight, you get meltwater. And then you get microbial mats, which are dark because the microbes are living in brilliant sunlight, so they have to have very strong dark pigment to protect the cells from UV radiation. And so that makes for more meltwater. And so there's no doubt that the organ, you know, the Cameron explosion, you know, was a radiation of the survivors of the Snowball Earth, which potentially could include the earliest multicellular animals.
And phylogenetic evidence supports that theory.
That's right.
Like molecular biology, the molecular and the construction
clock,
of trees.
So-called. If you make a phylogenetic tree and you date the branch points from, you know, the steady rate of mutations and whatnot, then you project back to a last common ancestor for all multicellular animals is around 720 million years ago.
It's interesting. I think one of the most interesting points you raised in today's talk is this idea that what impeded generalized acceptance of the snowball theory was the compartmentalization of academic knowledge, everybody in their own silos. I mean, because the arguments that you made today were, I mean, splendidly multidisciplinary. We're talking geology, geochemistry, paleoclimatology, marine biology, ecology, evolutionary biology, genomics,
yeah.
And that it's only by bringing together evidence, yeah, from all these fields, which any one of these individuals really knows very little or nothing about because they're specialized.
That's right.
To put all the pieces together.
So the idea came out of climate physics, and then it was developed by planetary people, but they thought it had never happened because they didn't talk to geologists. The geologists didn't read the climate physics literature. And so the geologists had all the evidence, but it didn't make any sense to them. They thought it was ridiculous, and so they sort of ignored the evidence.
So how did interest in this idea change your own academic trajectory, Paul Hoffman? Because you started off as a hard rock geologist.
Well, I started off as a sedimentary geologist, and I applied my sedimentary geology to problems in tectonics and geodynamics, which is basically, you know, how continents move around and oceans open and close and how the crust is formed and how the crust is deformed and things like that. And so that's a combination of geology and solid earth geophysics. And I, you know, had never worked in stable isotopes or in evolutionary biology or in you know, low temperature geochemistry. And those were the critical fields that I needed for Snowball Earth.
What would you say to somebody, I mean, to put forward a rather facetious idea that, well, I mean, everybody's talking about climate change and global warming, and Jim Hansen published, yeah, a paper that's not, yeah, actually been widely accepted,
right,
that we're actually, you know, going on a trajectory of towards hothouse Earth,
yep,
serious hothouse Earth,
yep,
perhaps 10 or 15
that's
degrees Celsius,
physics.
And that this is planet Earth's future.
Yeah.
But I would imagine from what we've been talking about that Earth could well be moving over some long period of time to another snowball Earth situation.
Oh, it could happen in the future. For various reasons, it may be less likely now than before, but it could happen. Right now, we're on a warming trajectory, so the snowball aftermath is more relevant. Come back to the climate thing. Now, it might be interesting that my interest in climate was really tweaked by the first Greenland ice cores, because those Greenland ice cores, right through the entire Greenland ice sheet, gave you a climate record, a paleoclimate record, with annual resolution over the last 100,000 years. And those records were published in 1989, just before I got interested in. And I looked at those records and I said, climate science is going to start to become really important because we have this kind of resolution record. This is going to become very serious science. And so I was thinking that tectonics, plate tectonics, is kind of getting old. It's less exciting than it used to be. I was searching around for a new exciting field. I mean, you want to find the fastest moving stream. And given global warming, which is, you know, real physics, because I've taken the trouble to learn it, if you're going to be a university professor at Harvard, you need to know about these things. So I've read that literature. And so I decided this would be a good field to get into.
So you're publishing a book. It's coming out called Snowball Earth in 4G. And this gets back to the idea of, you know, in order to understand the snowball Earth idea, you've got to move outside your box and into, yeah, other disciplines. So the four G's are geology, geophysics, geochemistry, and geobiology. When is the book coming out, Snowball Earth in 4G?
It should be out in the next couple of months. Now, it's being published in China, so the distribution is a little bit more uncertain at this point because of the the fuel oil issue, which is has its most direct effect in South and East Asia. So how it will be distributed from Nanjing, where it's being published, is a bit uncertain. But, yeah, it should be out in the next 2 or 3 months.
And what's the central idea?
And it started as a COVID project.
Huh.
So it took me 4.5 years.
Wow. And I presume it's for academics. It's not for general readers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's for senior undergraduates, first-year graduate students. That's what it's aimed for. There is a marvelous book about Snowball Earth for a more general audience written many years ago now, 2004, by Gabriel Walker, called Snowball Earth, The Great Global Catastrophe That Gave Rise to Life as We Know It, I think is the subtitle. Snowball Earth by Gabriel Walker. And it's a very good book because, first of all, it's written for a layman, and it really gives a sense of the debate and that was taking place at that time. And the deep and the emotions, what really, I knew it was going to be controversial. I went back and read all the early papers on the great controversy over the Quaternary glaciations back in the 19th century just to get to prepare myself for the controversy I knew was coming. Because, it was my good fortune that this thing fell into my lap as a mature scientist. And I'd been through a few scientific wars in the past, and so I knew it was coming. But I wasn't, and incidentally, the personality types are no different now than they were in the 1840s. I was taken aback by the emotion, how emotionally charged it got. People thought I was really bringing the science into disrepute.
And now it's widely accepted.
Now it has been widely accepted now for 10 years.
What are a last question? What are the nagging questions that remain about the Snowball Earth theory? What are the questions that haven't been answered? What are the anomalies we don't quite yet understand?
The impact on the evolution of life and how this is expressed in the genomes of living organisms.
Because today living organisms possess and embody in their genomes the evidence of what happened back in these Snowball Earth periods, is what you're saying.
All living things descended from the survivors of Snowball Earth. And that was a very select subset of what had evolved before Snowball Earth. What survived were the organisms and the ecosystems that had already adapted to glacial environments. And they survived. And we evolved from them. And that evolutionary history is encoded in the genomes of living organisms. But what the problem is, we have to convince biologists, evolutionary biologists and molecular biologists, to look for this evidence. Because so far, the evidence that has been found so far has been stumbled upon by accident. Because biologists are not looking for it yet because they haven't heard that Snowball Earth is widely accepted in geology. And geologists, being such a very tiny, tiny, scientific community relative to biology, which is monstrous, we have to shout really loud to be heard.
Well, perhaps people will be listening to you on the Green Planet Monitor.
good deal.
Thank you so much, Paul Hoffman, for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Paul Hoffman is a leading Canadian geologist and McMaster University grad, renowned for his pioneering research on Proterozoic carbonates and the application of plate tectonics to Earth's early history. He's best known for developing the Snowball Earth hypothesis. Paul Hoffman has been doing geology fieldwork in northern Namibia since 1993. Listen to my complete conversation with Paul Hoffman and subscribe to the GPM at greenplanetmonitor.net. You are listening to the Green Planet Monitor. I'm David Kattenberg.